You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition, 2, 1, 0, we have a liftoff. We have a liftoff and it's lighting up the areas. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center. The Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. And my thanks go out this week to the ESO Network crowd for having us aboard as their latest show in their stable of podcasts. It's quite an honor, and we appreciate it. That's why you got that little bit at the beginning of the show, and you'll see another little bit at the end. This week's guest is Bobby Polite. I have known Bobby for many years now. And one of the first creative things that he and I did together, beginning way back in 1996, was to co-create the universe of characters and situations that gave birth, in part, to The Sentinels, which is the series of novels that I'm sort of known for, in part. And, of course, in 2005, I revived that particular part of our shared universe to write the books. I'm still working on them today. Other characters that Bobby created or co-created continue to show up in the books, most notably Star Knight and his supporting characters and situations. In short, Bobby is an extremely insightful and creative storyteller with a rare knack for clever plotting and very fun characters. And I'm not just saying that because he's on the show. I honestly believe it, and I feel very privileged that I've had him to work with over the years. Bobby, it's great to have you on.
Well, thank you for having me here. Good to be here.
Great. This is going to be part one of a multi-part series that I'm planning to do in which we discuss superheroes and superheroes particularly done in prose form, because that's, I think, a growing field. A few years ago, it really only existed either as fan fiction or as licensed novels and anthologies, you know, of existing big characters. For example, I still have my Marvel anthologies and novels from back in the 1970s, like the David Michelinie, The Man Who Stole Tomorrow, which is the Avengers versus Kang. And I've still got my Marvel Superheroes one that included like an X-Men story and a Hulk story and maybe a Daredevil story or something. Did you ever have those? Do you remember those books?
I remember those books. I never actually had them. I didn't really start getting novelizations until around the time, you know, when Byrne wrote the Wonder Woman novel.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were anthologies that came out. Was it Brian Priest? Is that the right – how to pronounce that name?
I'm not sure.
He you know, they did the Ultimate Frankenstein and things like that, and they came out with books that had superhero stories, but they weren't necessarily licensed.
Right.
I didn't really read a whole lot of that because a lot of times those stories seem more like science fiction or fantasy to me than they did superheroes.
And that's true. And I think that that's one of the things that I like about doing superheroes in prose is that you can make it in some ways as much a science fiction novel or a sort of space fantasy novel as a superhero novel. I like being able to use superhero characters as if they were science fictional characters. I mean, I've said this before. I don't see a whole lot of functional difference between a superhero with a superpower and Captain Kirk in a Star Trek novel with a phaser and a communicator. You know, in both cases, you have a heroic character who has some tool or ability at their disposal.
That's funny you should say that, because I find that when I'm working and thinking about stories for Star Knight and where to take him, I waffle back and forth between him being, you know, the Captain Marvel, Green Lantern type character to a kid who's basically got an artifact that makes him the Starship Enterprise in space.
Yeah.
And getting a little too descriptive with how the sensors work and how the beams work and, you know, what he can do, as opposed to just being, you know, I'm out there. I'm not going to get deep in explaining the technology behind this because it's basically magic. You know, they don't explain a lot about Iron Man's armor. They just come up with a bunch of pseudoscience.
Right. Oh, exactly. So. Right. Yeah. It does what he needs it to do in that story. Right. And then they just, you know, occasionally they'll go in and give you a schematic or something, but generally it's magical. It does what it, you know, it does what whatever it needed to be able to do.
Right.
So.
Right.
Well, Yeah, so those are the books. I mean, DC has done a few, Marvel's done a few over the years that sort of got the thing going. But I've always said the one real drawback to doing existing characters of Marvel or DC or Dark Horse or anybody was that you know the comics have to lead the way. Real changes to the characters have to happen in the comics. And what that does is it sort of hamstrings the novels and the short stories because they're not allowed to make substantive changes to the universe of the character the way the comics can. They can't, for example, do a Hulk novel and kill the Hulk. I mean, if they did, they'd have to bring him back. You have to hit the reset button with novels. And so one of the things that I've enjoyed working with the Sentinels and with the stuff that you and I have worked in over the years is that we could, because the novels in our case is the primary, they represent the primary vehicle for telling the story and for having the characters change and evolve, we can actually do substantive changes in the novels. You know, people die, people change, because that's the vehicle.
Well, one of the things, though, too, is that these are our own created characters. Mm-hmm. They don't have a lot of weight of history behind them. Mm-hmm. So they're not like the institutions that Superman, Batman, and all these other characters are, where I think that if you do too much change to them, mm-hmm. you lose a lot of their history, which is part of my problem with comics nowadays, mm-hmm. is that they don't respect the history of these characters as much, and a writer will come in and do just amazingly weird things to the character and then not put the character back in place for the next writer to pick up and make changes to. They always have to constantly undo things.
Yeah.
You know, but our characters, they're not intended to be these episodic characters. They're long-term growth characters, and they'll live and die in their own stories.
That's right. Yeah, that's good. Well, before we go further into that, which I think, and we're going to do that before we're done for sure, let's kind of dig back to the beginning with you and me both. You and I were born within a couple of weeks of each other. We kind of grew up in two different areas, but reading the same sorts of things, enjoying the same sorts of things, and that's one of the reasons I think that you and I have always had a very good sort of a collaborative relationship is that we may not always have the same opinions about everything, but we pretty much are coming from the same place to start with and see things sort of the same. So we started out reading comics in probably the mid 70s.
Pretty much.
And what was it that you liked about it then at that point in time? What drew you to it?
Oh, well, wow. I mean, the first few comics I got were Spider-Mans and things, and I don't remember a whole lot about them. But the first comic book that really pulled me in is I got issue 148 of The Avengers.
Yeah.
And I had no idea the difference between Marvel and DC at the time. I kept wondering when I was reading the issue what these people had to do with Batman and Superman, who were really the only superheroes that people knew about.
Mm-hmm.
What drew me in were just the varied characters, the costumes, the different power sets, the overly dramatic dialogue, you know, my stars and garters and cheese and crackers from the Beast and, Hellcat during that issue. Yeah. I just loved all the costumes and the different power sets. That fascinates me. I love all that, just all the color to it. And that's what really got me into reading it and looking for other comic books at that point, was just to see the whole gamut of characters that were out there. I mean, if you put an issue in front of me and there was a character I'd never seen before, I'm like, oh, I got to read that.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
it's funny, by the way, the way that you described it just now. I've tried to describe for friends over the years why I like college football so much, and that pretty much is the same reason. I like the different power sets of the different types of players, and I like all the colorful excitement and everything. So I've always thought that the two, that comic book superheroes and football, kind of had a lot in common, but yet there's not a whole lot of bleed over between the two audiences. So this is interesting. Well, anyway, I guess for me, somebody first showed me a copy of a Justice League comic from about probably 1975, 76. And it was one of their annual crossovers with the Justice Society. And I liked it. I mean, I thought it was pretty cool. I had probably seen Superman and Batman and maybe Wonder Woman before. And I thought it was pretty cool. And I was probably about, let's see, we were both about 7 or 8 years old at that point. And, But the DC characters even when I was 7 or 8 years old, I just found the DC characters a little more corny. They just seemed a little more stuffy. they didn't seem as free. They almost seemed like they were having to follow a script as opposed to being living, breathing characters. And
I have to agree with that. I really didn't like – once I started realizing the difference between Marvel and DC, I didn't really like the DC characters very much. I guess I kind of associated them with Super Friends too much.
Yeah, that's true.
And as I grew up, the Super Friends became less and less appealing to me.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, I start discovering other characters in the Marvel Universe, and when I hit the X-Men –
yeah.
When I bought issue 112, I'd never heard of him before in my life. I'd seen one picture of Wolverine somewhere, and I thought he looked kind of cool. Mm-hmm. I read the X-Men, and suddenly I'm like, wow, this is just completely different than everything I read. Everything else is, we're a bunch of guys who've got powers, and we're fighting the big bad guy, whereas this is a family that has powers and are together, and they care about each other, and I started caring about them. I mean, caring about them like I've never cared about characters before in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And that really, really got me into it. And that was the first time I really paid attention to who was actually writing and drawing the comics.
Right, right.
Because
that
John Byrne is the first person that I went, I'm looking for stuff by him.
Yeah.
Claremont, I'm looking for stuff by him. And then I found Marvel Team Up, and then the whole Marvel Universe just took off for me because it was so interconnected by them back then. You know, thank Jim Shooter.
Well, right. It is kind of funny to imagine jumping from like a mid-70s Justice League to a Chris Claremont, John Byrne X-Men. I mean, that has to be, you know, like from the Stone Age to the Space Age in one jump, you know. And
DC eventually started figuring it out because they got Marv Wolfman and George Perez to come over and do the Titans.
Do the Titans, right.
And when that started, I started getting into DC.
Sure.
So.
Yeah, and looking back, you know, later on in life, you can appreciate what DC was doing. I mean, it's something that when you're a little kid, you just want that visceral, emotional feel of which one you think is going to make you happiest, you know, and
right.
You're not looking at them and going, I can appreciate what they are trying to accomplish here. You're just like, oh, that's cool or that's not cool. So, yeah, so somebody gave me Avengers number 162. That was my first real Marvel comic.
I love that issue.
And it's the second part of the, you know, in 160, the Grim Reaper has the trial of Wonder Man and the Vision. And he always seems to be associated with Ultron, so you could kind of see what was coming. Of course, at the time we couldn't, but you know, I couldn't. But and then I didn't have 161 for years and years and years because it had already been sold out, I guess, by the time I got 162. But 162 is the Bride of Ultron, where Pym has been kidnapped by Ultron, has been brainwashed, and is trying to put Jan's spirit, brain, soul, whatever, into the metal body of the character that would eventually be Jocasta. And there's just that awesome Perez cover with the Avengers all battling Ultron, and he's just standing there defiant as the hammer's bouncing off of him, the repulsors are bouncing off of him, and was just epic.
Well, and it opens up with the, you know, they're wheeling out
the dead
Avengers
bodies
that are supposed to be dead. You know, Cap's the one I'm going to miss the most and all that stuff. And, you know, I learned the word dolt from that issue. but I can still see the dialogue, you know.
Yes.
They burst in and he's like, Wonder Man, what, not dead? No, not yet. You know, that's why I'm hoping that we'll see Ultron somewhere in the Avengers movies. He's my favorite Avengers villain by far.
Yeah, he is such a great – well, he has such good family connections, and he has motivations. He has a cool power set. He's indestructible, when you do the adamantium part.
Right.
That beginning that you mentioned where they were dead, I mean, imagine your first issue of a Marvel comic is when these characters that you've just peripherally ever heard of, like Captain America, the Beast, Scarlet Witch, are being brought out on stretchers to the ambulance and they're dead. You know, that had a huge impact on me. And the beginning of the Shiva advent is when I was trying to capture that vibe. I have, at the very beginning of the fourth Sentinels novel, the beginning of the second trilogy, I have, Pulsar arrives at Ezra Brakus's mansion and finds that a big robot has come and killed several members, apparently, too. So that was very, very deliberately. I mean, I knew that Avengers fans that were reading it would go, oh, I know exactly what he's doing here, and that was fine. But that was just to show just what an impact that did indeed, you know, have on me as the beginning of my love of superheroes and comics. So what other things did you read early on that you really liked and had a big impact on you?
One of the things that had probably the biggest impact is at the time I was reading the Avengers, the X-Men, Iron Man, and I was reading Marvel Team Up.
Yeah.
And because Claremont and Byrne were doing Marvel Team Up and they were doing the X-Men, they had these crossovers that were not official crossovers going back and forth where you know, the Beast would hear from Havoc about the X-Men disappearing, and he would go off and appear in issue 11 of the X-Men and find out they've been kidnapped by Mesmero. And there were all these little interconnections. You know, there's a reference where they're trying to figure out why members of the Avengers are disappearing, and Iron Man's like, well, Thor's fighting this big stone giant out in the harbor. And that's Marvel Team Up 70, where he's fighting the Living Monolith.
Yeah.
And all that interconnection is what really, I love that. And even to this day, when I'm running RPGs and mm-hmm. when I'm thinking about storylines, I'm always thinking about how all this stuff is happening concurrently and how it all interconnects. And that right there fascinated me. It's something that DC never had.
Right.
To any degree, I miss the little way back in issue 57, Al, you know, things that used to be in Marvel comic books.
The captions and the footnotes, yeah.
And I think that's one of the big reasons I've gotten away from Marvel is because they don't have a continuity anymore. They have a bunch of different continuities, and it's hard to keep track of which one's which.
Yeah.
You know, 17 different versions of the Hulk running around is stupid. That's what I didn't like about DC. There were too many versions of the same characters running around.
Right. Well, sure. That Marvel team-up example is great because it really shows you how at Marvel, during that period in particular, even their sort of lesser-known books were doing stuff like that. I mean, Marvel Team-Up, it did have the virtue of being a Spider-Man book, but it wasn't a Spider-Man book where a Spider-Man fan would go to get the latest, you know, update on what Spider-Man or Peter Parker or Mary Jane or any of them were up to. It was much more story-driven, wouldn't you say?
Oh, and issues fed into other issues, which fed into other issues. You know, Marvel Chillers with Tigra wrapped up with the Yellow Jacket, Wasp, Spider-Man fighting Equinox, fighting the mm-hmm. Super Skrull stuff, you know, all those interconnections that occurred back then were fabulous, especially if you read the books, but you didn't have to read them to enjoy the story. You didn't have to know why the Super Skrull was in the Soul Catcher. You just, you know, it wasn't necessary to read the story.
I think that Chris Claremont, I don't know for sure, and I've met him a couple of times. I've never asked him this. I wish I had now. I think that maybe what he had in mind, it just seems to me, is that, you know, if you do a book that is essentially an all-star book, it's their most popular character at the time, Spider-Man, and some other character. So that kind of a comic is the kind that people don't buy every month. It's the kind necessarily, right? It's the kind you'd see on the rack. And you go, oh, Spidey's teamed up with the Hulk. Cool, I'll get it. Oh, Spidey's teamed up with Man-Thing. Oh, I'll pass.
But that was a good issue.
Right. And so what Claremont probably was thinking is, I've got to do something that will bring people back every month and not have them picking and choosing not to buy every other issue or something. Does that make sense, maybe?
Oh, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I think, I don't know, I wasn't there, but I also kind of give Jim Shooter some credit for that.
Yeah.
Because I think he was doing a really good job of making sure the universe worked together and nobody was contradicting themselves and that there were little references back and forth. And I'm sure the writers were all talking to each other going, hey, I'm going to mention this in my book.
Yeah.
You know? So,
and some of them like doing that, some of them don't, right?
I mean, some don't.
Some of them would rather just have independence to do whatever they want and not have to keep the continuity. I know when we, back, you know, years ago when I did MV1, the fan fiction thing for a while, we were trying very hard to emulate that old school Marvel feeling of where the writers would coordinate. And some writers loved it and would set up databases and there would be email groups and everything. And other writers are like, just leave me alone. Let me tell a story. So it's always a controversial kind of approach, you know, and you need a strong editor that can kind of mandate it and hold that approach together, I think. When did you, if ever, because I don't know if we've ever even talked about this before. When did you ever start what happened that made you start liking DC more? Was it the Teen Titans?
It was really the Teen Titans. It was the introduction of a bunch of new characters. Again, like I said, if it's a character I've never seen, I'm going to be interested in it. That's why I read Marvel Team Up, because it's like, oh, here's Red Sonja. Oh, here's Miss Marvel. Oh, you know, a bunch of different characters. But I think when Teen Titans started and I got the Captain Carrot issue or that had the little Teen Titans in it, I think the character that really drew me in was Raven.
Yeah.
I just like the look of Raven. And the fact that it was George Perez drawing the art
sure
pulled me in because, you know, obviously I really liked him on the Avengers and pretty much everything else he did.
Absolutely.
And it was a good story. I mean, it was a good – it felt like how they had written comics at Marvel. And that pulled me more into it. And then what was the thing that – was it John Ostrander did? Was it Legends? Is that what it was called? The little four-issue miniseries?
Yeah, that sounds familiar. I'm not a scholar of DC back in that period, but that does sound familiar to me.
Byrne drew it, and it's kind of reintroduced characters. It reintroduced Captain Marvel. That started pulling me in more too. During that time period. So
they started building a little more of a Marvel-like universe around themselves that they really hadn't had before, right? I mean,
I didn't think so, no.
That was the thing that DC always kind of did, is Marvel had a universe. DC had their cities, right? You know, DC was very oriented around their main characters, each having their own city, which is just kind of odd when you – you know, when you try to shift that into more of a Marvel Universe approach, a DC Earth, then suddenly you've got all the American cities that already exist, plus new ones.
Well, but Marvel's origins were, you know, just a few creators adding on characters and crossing over characters from the very, very beginnings, whereas DC was a bunch of different characters that began separately.
Separately, right.
And were brought together. And they didn't initially exist in the real world. You had Metropolis instead of New York. You had, mm-hmm. you know, what, Coast City, supposed to be San Diego or something like that?
Yeah.
I don't.
Keystone City, and there's just a bunch of them, yeah. So it is very, and they're all called City. Gotham City, right. Except for Metropolis, obviously. Well, what other creators? We talked about Wolfman and Perez. We talked about Claremont and Byrne. What other creators haven't we talked about that probably need to be mentioned as having like a big impact on us and how we saw comics and superheroes?
Oh, Dave Michelinie, Bob Layton.
Yeah.
Iron Man. That was, you know, Iron Man's. I'm dumbfounded today how popular Iron Man is, because back in the day, nobody really read that comic book. I think it was constantly in danger of being canceled.
Oh, don't even.
and I loved that period of Iron Man. It was fantastic.
We were just in Target last night or yesterday, and my wife was showing me some Iron Man stuff, and I got me an Iron Man toboggan, which is kind of cool. And you know, she was talking about, do you want this? Do you want this? I said, no, I don't want all that stuff. And then I said, you know, if the movie had been able to just come along 10 years earlier, I'd have had all this stuff. You know, I would have had everything, because this was my favorite character. And I can remember month after month back in the 70s and in the early 80s, every month I would flip through the ads. You know, when I'd come to an ad, they would always have like the Heroes World or Superhero Shops, whatever, ads, yeah. All the toys. And there'd be a Spider-Man thing. There'd be a Captain America thing. There'd be a Hulk thing. Maybe there'd be a Thor thing. But there was hardly ever any Iron Man stuff.
I think there was a Mego Iron Man.
Yeah, there was. He had the nose.
But he also had a cloth armor.
Yeah. A plastic head and cloth armor, right. I never had him. I had to make my own. I think I took like my Captain Kirk and made armor for him. I'm instruction paper. So, yeah, I mean, I would have killed. I mean, I probably spent hours making Iron Man toys for myself, and now you can't turn around in the toy section without tripping over it, and I just don't care. So they just, you know, they came along a little too late. I see people all gaga over how cool Iron Man is now, and I'm just like, you just don't even know. where were you when he was fighting Justin Hammer on the floating island, you know, and beating
up the
super army? Yeah, all that stuff. Yeah, you mentioned Michelinie and Layton, and for those that don't know, he and the two of them and John Romita Jr., back when he could actually draw, they would do they did a run. Well, they did two runs, I guess. I guess Layton was on the second one of Iron Man that were absolutely classic. That really, I think, defined the modern character to some degree, wouldn't you say?
Well, there's a number of things that happened that kind of feed off of those issues in the movies and things like that.
Yeah.
A lot of that stuff, that period is, I think, if without that period of growth in Marvel from the X-Men, especially the X-Men, we might not have the movies we have today.
Mm-hmm.
That's just my feeling.
I think the 60s created those characters and set them in motion, but it was really those sort of early, mid, maybe even late 70s books and creators that really made them, like you say, what they became with the movies and everything.
Yeah.
I think that's when they really found the sweet spot for each one of those characters, kind of what they are. Because, I mean, that's when Tony Stark became not just the the government contractor who has a heart condition, he became like the playboy, the alcoholic, but still a really good guy, you know, and still somebody you could cheer for on top of all that. And, you know, that defined the character all the way to today. It's also, unfortunately, when, like, for example, a Henry Pym got defined for all eternity as the wife, you know, which
that makes me mad to this day. I wish that had never happened.
He still cares. I mean, you know, that one incident from one writer. Now, that's not to excuse hitting your wife, obviously. That's not what I mean. What I mean is when one writer makes a decision about a character that's been around for so long, and that one decision by one writer comes to literally define the character from then forward, that's just unfortunate, I think.
Well, that's one of those things that I'm talking about not repairing your characters along the way. Yeah. Because that, you know, Henry Pym has been around since before there was really a Marvel Comics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, before there was a superhero universe. He, you know, and now he's a wife beater. He's, you know, I don't know. I just that's an issue that upset me when I was reading it. And it's one of those things that I go back and forth about, because part of me looks at comic books and I'm like, well, I'd, you know, if I had kids, I'd want my kids to read these things. But would I really want them to read them now?
I know.
I'm not sure I would.
Yeah.
Because it seems to me a lot of comics are written for, well, they're written for us, older kids. And they kind of leave out younger kids, because with the number of rape references and things like that that go on in comic books nowadays, and the fact that they all seem like just gangs in costumes fighting each other,
yeah,
and there's not really good guys and bad guys as much anymore. I don't want my kids reading that. So
yeah, it's
I want them to have an ideal.
Right. Well, I feel like they are making comics today for who they think we are, but I don't think that they are exactly right in who they think that we are. I think that they're making certain assumptions, and I think it's costing them market share and customers every month. I mean, increasingly, you know, the old crowd, you know, you and I started an Avengers mailing list in 1996, and it's essentially still around, but there's probably not a handful of people on it anymore that actually buy comics anymore. That's not anything to talk about anymore. So it's just amazing how they've failed over the years to bring in new readers, and they've alienated the ones that they already have. And it's what's amazing to me. It shows you the love that really does exist for so many of these characters that they're still in business, you know, because they, and it's really the movies today, I think, that are doing a much better job of getting these characters across to a mass audience, obviously.
Well, the comics are big advertisements now.
Yeah. They're monthly pamphlets advertising the next movie, I guess.
Well, and there's too much formula in it, because, you know, it used to be you would go along and you'd be reading a book and you'd go, oh, well, here's a two-parter, here's a one-issue story, here's a three-issue story, here's a five-issue story. Now it's like, we must do all stories in three issues. That way we can print them in the trade paperback.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just predictable.
Yeah,
and,
you know.
And too many storylines get repeated. I mean, how many times are we going to bring back Jean Grey and kill her off? I mean, Phoenix and all, yeah, fine. That gets old, really old fast.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No.
Bitter comics fan there.
Well, hey, no, I think that's a lot of what of our generation is left are sort of bitter comics fans that they sort of taken us for granted, but they don't quite know how to address what we would like to see. It's kind of sad. How could those companies go about recapturing your attention and your affection again, if at all? I mean, is it too late? Has that ship sailed, or is there something that they could do that, well, you'd say, you know, I might give them a chance?
Well, you know, I've almost come back to read Marvel Comics a couple of times for different things. Like when Miss Marvel came back and got her own book, mm-hmm, I came back for that because she's always been one of my favorite characters.
Right, me too.
When X-Men First Class started up, I was, you know, first in line to get that issue, and then it kind of went south. And, you know, I even paid attention because apparently they're bringing the original X-Men forward in time to be in the current universe. So now we've got three Cyclopses and 17 Beasts.
Oh, no.
But and that intrigues me until I go, no, you've burned me too many times. I'm going to stick with Atomic Robo, and that's it.
Yeah, I had kind of whittled my – yeah, I was a big Marvel reader all the way well, the first run back in the 70s and 80s, and I came back to it in 92 with the Infinity stuff. I'm a big Jim Starlin fan. People that have read my books and stuff over the years will probably know that I'm very influenced by Jim Starlin. And so all the cosmic stuff I love. I can't wait for the Guardians of the Galaxy movie. And I guess I'm the only one that probably can't wait for the Guardians of the Galaxy movie.
I would be waiting for the Guardians of the Galaxy movie if it was the original Guardians of the Galaxy.
I understand that, yeah. But I love the Dan Abnett versions too, so I'm just as excited as I would be for the other crowd. That's a valid point. But because I liked the cosmic stuff so much, when they did the Infinity Gauntlet, the Infinity War, that brought me back in. I started reading them again. And that was when I really came to appreciate some of the other stuff like DC, and then branched out and started reading things like Bone, some of the Dark Horse stuff. So there for a while, I felt
Strangers in Paradise.
Strangers in Paradise. Yeah, absolutely. So for a while, I felt like I was really kind of sampling all over the comics world, all different kinds of stuff. There was the cross-gen stuff for a while that was really good.
Well, before cross-gen, the thing that got me back into comics was Valiant.
Yeah, yeah.
I had everything Valiant ever published until it started going downhill when, you know, Claim bought them, and it stopped losing its coherence. You know, before then it was a very coherent universe, and then it started being kind of market driven, and that bugged me. So it just kind of petered out. It's kind of sad because I was looking forward to the day, you know, in 1999 when Shadow Man was supposed to be killed and that sort of thing, and that never came to pass. And yeah. Then I was on board with CrossGen too until they went under. But
and these were all – I think that they both represented very legitimate, very sincere efforts to just do something different. I mean, they weren't telling drastically different stories necessarily – than the other companies, but they were approaching it with, I think, a certain degree of integrity, maybe.
Well, and CrossGen was cool to me because that was the first time that anybody figured out how to take so many different genre books and make them into a coherent universe by having these sigils all across the place.
So you had
your Roman army, you know, you had your high fantasy in Meridian, you had your space opera in Sigil, you know.
And Negation. Negation.
And, yeah, the Negation stuff was fantastic. It was just kind of amazing that they brought all that together. And then you had the first in the background with all the politics and the two factions fighting each other. I never thought I would like that book, but that was one of the best books when it was going.
That was very Amber, very Zelazny-like. I liked that one from the beginning for that reason, yeah.
I think of it now in terms of the Exalted RPG.
Right.
It seemed like that, so...
Yeah, that was what drew me to it, though, was the idea of immortal beings squabbling and hating each other and sometimes killing each other. That's one of the things I've always loved about Roger Zelazny stuff and the Amber stuff is the squabbling princes and princesses that all hate each other and want to kill each other and take over.
Yeah.
And they were also doing stuff like Ruse, where I guess Mark Waid was writing essentially kind of a Sherlock Holmes with a very smart leading lady character. And
right.
And they had the Japanese stuff, too.
She was, I think she was one of the first, wasn't she?
Or she had a connection. She has, or even if she didn't know it, it's been a while. I can't even remember exactly, but yeah, she did have something going. Couldn't she stop time or something strange?
She could do something, and I think she was told she wasn't supposed to interfere. Ruse was one that I collected and only really read a few of because I was busy reading other books and I never got back to reading it. Mm-hmm. But I enjoyed like Crux. I like the Atlanteans with their different power sets. And,
yeah.
And they were literally, it seemed to be, going to be at the crux of what was going on because I think the first were the Atlanteans that disappeared.
Oh, yeah.
You know, back in time. So, but, oh, well.
Yeah, you know, the other thing that CrossGen did in terms of business practice that I thought was so great was they started putting out a monthly couple of trade paperbacks. You know, we're used to trade paperbacks having like six issues or whatever of Batman or six issues of the Avengers or something. But instead, or rather in addition to it, they would put out a book, two different books every month, and each of the two had half of everything they'd put out the previous month.
Right.
So you'd get like issue number six of so-and-so and issue number three of so-and-so, whatever came out that month. And I thought that was a brilliant move because there would be – the price would be low enough that you didn't hate, you know, to buy it. And what was really good about it was you get all these things you wanted, and then you'd have these others that you basically were getting for free when you bought the ones you wanted, and you could try them out. And you might go, oh, I like that too. And here was the thing. If you did like them, it's not like you were going to go buy the comics. You could just keep getting that thing, and you had more to read in those issues, in those books every month. It didn't cost you any more money if you decided that you liked Way of the Rat. It just meant that there was another extra story in your collection next month that you would read. Right. So that was, I just thought that was a great idea, and I would have loved if Marvel had done something similar to that, or DC maybe, you know, since I was less likely to buy DC on a monthly basis, if they had put out something that had like the, you know, one issue of Superman, one issue of Batman, one issue of Wonder Woman that I wouldn't have read otherwise, you know, and one issue of Green Lantern. You know, I'd have bought that every month just to get that much material and try out something I didn't necessarily read.
Yeah, no, I agree. They did a lot of nice experimenting with formats.
Yeah, and unfortunately, did Disney end up owning them? Is that what I heard recently?
Disney bought them, I think, for a book. I think it was called Alakazam or something like that.
Yeah,
but they've got them. Seems like Disney has everybody now.
Yeah,
really. They're Time Warner. Going to have two big media companies feeding us everything before long. I wish they would do something with Meridian. I think Meridian was my favorite. It was a beautiful world. It was a very romantic story. And
was that the one with the flying ships or something like that?
It was the one where the world was falling apart and pieces of it were rising up. So you had these floating islands and flying ships.
Yeah.
And you had Persephone,
yeah,
who had one sigil and her uncle had the other. And they were, you know, one was the yellow sigil of peace and construction and healing and health and stuff. The other one was the red sigil of destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And they were fighting each other, you know, over who would control the area.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, they had so many good books like that that were just not something you would ever see from one of the big companies. So, well, before this becomes the CrossGen podcast, which would be cool someday, if comics aren't doing it for you and me these days, and they're not really, what would you say your current favorite medium is for enjoying imaginative type stories? Is it novels, movies, TV? What do you think is really working the best these days?
I'm reading more short stories than I am novels. I find I don't have time to commit to novels as much because I'll pick them up and read them. And I have a bad habit that when I put a book down for about a week, I can't just pick it up. I got to start it over. So mostly when I have like 20 or 30 minutes, I'll sit down on my iPad and read through a short story or something like that. I don't watch much TV anymore. I watch just a few episodes of certain shows. So it's really movies, and I play a lot of role playing games.
Mm-hmm.
So I run a lot of role playing games.
Right, and so. I'm gonna touch on that in a couple of minutes. But I would say for me that I don't like watching regular TV. If not for DVRs, I probably would have given up episodic TV altogether. But the DVR, you know, lets us watch some of the family shows like Modern Family and The Big Bang Theory, but what we really enjoy, what my wife and I really enjoy, is the HBO dramas, and so, you know, we pay the money to get HBO just to have like one show, one series every 3 months or so, but it's worth it. And then, go ahead.
I watch those. I watch like True Blood. I all the way back to the Sopranos.
Yeah.
And after a while, I got tired of every episode asking 10 questions and answering 2.
Yeah. That's probably so.
And it started to feel. I started to feel like they were jerking my chain. There was a lot of formula to how they would do an episode, and I think True Blood's what drove me away from watching the HBO Showtime type stories. I mostly watch, you know, sitcoms. I'll watch Community. Mm-hmm. I think Community is about, at least it was, hopefully the new season will be. It was one of the most clever shows on TV. But
I tried to watch it just because it basically is a show about my professional life. But
yeah.
I kept thinking, if my students are like this, I'm getting nervous about going to work tomorrow. So, but yeah, it was pretty cleverly written for sure.
And then I'll go ahead and admit it. I watch My Little Pony. I love that show.
I know that you and your house guest there are a big fan of the. Of that whole pony universe. I've had a couple of students show up in class and stuff that they think nobody knows what it is. And I'm like, oh yeah. And they're like, what? And I'm like, uh-huh. And they're like, oh really? I'm like, oh yeah. I know what you're doing. I know what you got because you pointed it out to me at Dragon Con this year, and I was just like, holy crap, every other person here has a My Little Pony shirt on or something, and I never would have known it.
It was crazy. There were more people dressed up as pony characters than there were superheroes that I saw.
Yeah, or stormtroopers or anything. Yeah, it was crazy.
Well, the six that won the costume contest were dressed up as the main six from My Little Pony.
Good gosh.
So,
oh my goodness. Well, it certainly is on in my house a lot. I don't see it as much, but I'm either seeing it on the TV as I walk by, or I'm stepping on the little critters as I walk through the room. So let's see a couple more things that I wanted to get to. We're talking about what kind of things we're enjoying as far as what kind of media for enjoying a story. Where do you kind of invest your efforts in creativity these days? Now, you and I don't get to work together as much as we probably both would like.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, absolutely. But you've had an immeasurable impact, which I'll talk about in a minute, on the Sentinels universe and everything that, and its extended world that kind of includes a lot of your stuff too, one way or another. But beyond that, what kind of stuff creatively are you doing these days? You talk about RPGs. What kind of stuff have you been doing with your creativity?
A lot of my storytelling, my urge to tell stories falls into role playing right now. I've been running a shared Exalted RPG universe with some friends for 5 years, where each of our campaigns builds on the other campaign, and we've got a bunch of continuous characters that have been crossing over. And so I invest a lot of time into doing that, creating characters. I've got a huge wiki that I maintain the history of all the characters and what has happened and things of that nature. And I find it very enjoyable because, you know, I told you when we first started working that I have all these ideas, but I have a hard time myself putting them down on paper.
Mm-hmm.
Because I like interaction. I like somebody else's input.
Mm-hmm.
to because if I take my idea and put it down, it feels stale. But when somebody else gives me input and I go, wait, how can I use that?
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly it feels alive because there's an outside influence there. And when you're role playing, you've got people making decisions based on the situations you present, or more importantly, they will give you hints by the way they act of what they want to do. And suddenly you have to change your whole story mid game. The best games I've ever run have been ones where I planned to do one thing and everybody else wanted to do another. And I had to completely ad lib the whole story. And those are the ones they enjoy because the most, because they're doing what they want to do. They're taking their roles in the stories and running with them.
Yeah,
and I really, really get a lot of pleasure out of that.
No battle plan long survives contact with the enemy, right?
Oh, you have to approach role playing that way. If you go in with the idea that you're going to ram a story down your players' throats, nobody's going to enjoy it, and it's all going to feel very forced. And it took me a while to learn that, because I used to go, I've got a great plot, and you're going to witness it whether you want to or not. and that just never worked. And, you know, we do very heavy role-playing with Exalted, and then we take breaks and we play superhero stuff, where I run more four-color type of stuff, or Brett will run – Brett, my friend, who runs part of the Exalted universe,
mm-hmm.
he'll run four-color stuff, and that's been a lot of fun. We've switched off of Mutants and Masterminds to the new Marvel Heroic role-playing game, which, by the way, if you've been looking for a superhero role-playing game, I cannot recommend that more highly. It's story-driven as opposed to let's roll dice-driven.
Well, and that's certainly going to be useful to the people that I think that are RPG players. There's a lot of them out there. The fact that industry sustains itself, especially when the books are as expensive as they are, because they're sort of they're almost like collector's items. Every single thing that comes along, it seems like to me as an outsider, more or less in that community, that everything that comes along for those games is almost like a special one of a kind, you know, hardcover. They always struck me as something that's a little more special than just like another issue of a comic or another volume in a paperback series or something. Is that more or less true?
That's more or less true. For me, it's a good creative outlet. And like some of the stories that I had for Skyrocket,
mm-hmm.
that would be a
character that Bobby has used in some of his writing, and we've yet to introduce into the Sentinels. If we ever do, I don't know, but he's an awesome character. So we'll go ahead and say what you're saying about him.
Some of the stories that I had come up with involving Mr. Evil, I have actually done in the role-playing game, and they have very, very well. I've been very happy with that because I've never been able to get them down on paper.
Right.
But in that freeform environment, they've worked really well.
And it does let you kind of work out ideas and characters that you might, you know, use later in prose, right, as kind of they go.
Oh, I sat down the day that I was going to run it, and I wrote out a number of Mr. Evil's speeches and then practiced them alone in my bedroom so I could deliver them right.
That's great.
And actually the first one I did, which I'm not going to mention the name because I do hope to eventually write it as a story, and it will give something away. But that first one I did was probably the best role playing experience that I've ever had running the game. So.
Well, you know, I've got to say this. We're talking about the role playing games here for a minute. I think that RPGs are an absolutely valid storytelling medium. I think that it's easy to look at it as kind of it's a one-off. It has a very limited audience. You're never going to be able to sort of syndicate it out beyond just the people who are involved. But when you really come down to it, what is a story supposed to do? It's supposed to impact somebody. And who's to say if I publish a novel, more people will read it than play, you know, a game that you run. And your game may have a much bigger impact and create much more enjoyment for that small group than anybody who reads, you know, a book or something. So I think that's absolutely valid.
Well, you get personally invested in your characters. I mean, there were times with one of the characters I was playing in one of Brett's games that I was so emotionally involved in where this character was going. I would be a little strung up about it because I wanted things to work out right. And you know, I wanted that. It was no different than watching a movie where you get emotionally tied up with the characters, or reading a comic where you get emotionally tied up with the characters, and then if something wrong happens, it's upsetting.
But you know what, though? It is different, though, because when you're watching a movie or reading a comic or something, you can pick out that one character and love them to death, and then in George Martin, you know, George R. R. Martin may come along and kill them.
Or
Jim Shooter, right, yeah. Whereas with these characters, you at least do have some control over maybe not their ultimate fate, depending, but you at least have moment-to-moment control over what they're doing. So you can have an even bigger investment than in a character in a book or something, right?
Well, and they become your alter ego.
Right.
You know, if you let yourself get into the thing, and that's not easy because, you know, you are, you know, playing pretend as a grown-up with a bunch of other people. If you let yourself get into the character, you can become very invested in it, and it becomes very rewarding. I mean, it's just I refer to it as cooperative storytelling.
Right.
One person presents the situations and makes judgments about what's happening for the majority of the world. Everybody else gives their input and their reaction, and hopefully not just their reactions, but is proactive about where they want the story to go.
Yeah, I think that's completely a valid form of storytelling. And I mean, I say that because it sometimes gets, I think, unfairly impugned by people that really either don't understand it or don't understand the investment that goes into it, either in terms of time or effort or creativity or emotion or any of that. I think
humanity's storytelling started out more this way than it did writing. It was people sitting around campfires or sitting around a forum telling stories, and other people might get involved.
Oh yeah. Vladmar, what would you do? And then they'll say, I would take my sword and go over here and smite yon wolf.
Maybe not to that degree, but yeah. And I'm certain they weren't rolling dice.
They're rolling the heads of the guy they got mad at next to him at the fire, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. The last major topic I wanted to get into, now that we've kind of laid the foundation of what's influenced us, what we like, what we don't like, and how we kind of use it, is sort of how we've used it in these particular books. Because in the episodes to come, I'm going to be talking to various other writers who write superhero-type books in prose. There's at least one who does more Golden Age, kind of public domain characters. There's at least one who does very contemporary stuff with sort of very modern sensibilities and situations and so forth. How would you describe what we've sort of tried to do with the Sentinels universe in terms of, does it come across more Golden Age, more contemporary, more space fantasy? How would you, what's your sense of it?
I would say it's kind of a combination of the Bronze Age Marvel stuff meets sci-fi. Yeah. It's got some sci-fi, definite heavy sci-fi elements into it, because you know there's not a lot of costume Doc Ock types or Electro types with the big flamboyant costumes running around that make it more of a traditional superhero type thing. So I would, and we've tried to be a little more on the realistic side as far as how characters react and how they grow and the fact that they do change over time.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure I would call it just purely traditional comic books. I think it's sci-fi meets comic books.
Yeah. I've said to people before that what I felt like what I was trying to do with it was to tell stories of the same sort of scope you would get from like the Marvel Universe, where you could have a Daredevil level character doing something over here, and you could have, you know, the Kirby style space gods coming to eat the Earth over here. And you could have the guy in armor working on technology and everything over here. You can have the squabbling people living together in the headquarters over here. And you can have all that stuff going on at once. And when you would read them, when you'd read Marvel Comics, for example, over the years, you might have to read 6 or 7 different series a month to get all that at once. But Marvel did give you, and DC too, did give you the opportunity to experience all those different things in one universe. You know, it's a universe where there's the Kingpin, but there's also the Shi'ar and Galactus and the Celestials all at the same time. And that's kind of what I've striven for, is that you could read one paperback book and get little bits of all those things at the same time.
Oh yeah, yeah. You've got that, you ignore the scale. You know, most stories will have characters that are on the same scale. They won't have a Thor running around with a Daredevil,
right?
You know, or a Star Knight running around with Pulsar, yeah, for instance. You know, Star Knight can blast his way through a Star Destroyer. Mm-hmm. Pulsar couldn't. and you ignore that scale when you have those characters in some sort of conflict, but you accentuate it when they're by themselves.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think character development is a big part of it, because with a novel, you know, you're able to do all those various scenes that may not work quite as well in a comic book, that wouldn't be as desirable in a comic book, where you can have more introspection and conversations off to the side and things that you only get like a page or a few panels in the average comic book, but we can actually kind of explore it more. I'm trying to think what the page count averages out to, or rather the word count so far. The Sentinels Adventures to this point started with When Strikes the Warlord was volume 1 back in 2006, and then A Distant Star and Apocalypse Rising, and that was the first trilogy called The Grand Design. And then the second trilogy just wrapped up last year, and there's a new omnibus out with that trilogy too. Both of them are available in omnibus, gigantic books now. In fact, if you took the two omnibus paperbacks of the 6 novels, the total page count is over 1,300 pages.
Wow.
And it's approximately, they average about 70 to 80,000 words. When Strikes the Warlord's about 60. Stellar Axe Volume 6 is about 104,000 words. So they probably average, it's about 540,000 words at this point.
You know, it still amazes me that they're out in book form, because, you know, when we were first doing this, we were putting out what do we call them, graphically challenged comics?
Yeah.
where we were writing up short stories that had actual, you know, Astonishing Tales and the Sentinels and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And the Guardians and that sort of thing. And we were putting them out in these little pamphlets that we would fold over and staple and then hand them to our friends and go, hey, what do you think of this?
And we were always doing the cutting edge of the technology of it, though. You know, we were always looking for the next way to get the stuff out.
Oh, we bought that binder.
Yes,
and made our own novels basically before print on demand.
We pioneered print on demand. It was just us. It was just our demand.
We should go to Wikipedia right now and put ourselves in as pioneering print on demand.
I think that's absolutely true, though. I mean, we knew that we wanted print on demand before we knew what print on demand was, or before anybody was doing it.
That's true.
That was true. In 1996.
Right.
And when what ended up happening was we wrote one whole book, and we had done some other stories and things. But it was just, I think it was increasingly frustrating to us that we just couldn't reach the audience, at least to me. I mean, you and I have different sensibilities when it comes to, I mean, I think for, I don't want to speak for you, but let me put this out there and you react. I feel like for you, just the act of being creative can be its own reward, and that's fine. But for me, I really kind of need the validation of knowing people are reading it and enjoying it. And if not, I want to know why so I can fix it and do better. Does that seem fair to you? Or
no, that seems fair. As a matter of fact, that was probably one of the few places we had conflict, is that you were always wanting to put it way out there. And it's for me, writing it was enough.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was just fun, and it was nice to see all this stuff come together. And I think a little bit of it was a bit of fear, because I've never been real confident in my writing abilities. And so you wanted the validation. I was afraid of the invalidation.
Well, and those are both just human traits that we were both dealing with. But we did. And after a while, we kind of trailed off and moved on to other things. And the Sentinel sort of sat fallow for about a decade, really, till about till 2005. We had various other things going on in our personal lives that we were kind of limited in what we could do. But then by about 2005, I decided to pick them back up again and just put together. It was when I was actually living with you for a while. I'd moved back from Asia and didn't have a house and didn't have a job, and I was staying with you. And so being back in close approximation again kind of revived all that excitement that I had for those characters and everything. And so I had the time. And I had a laptop, so I started writing them, and you were right there kind of helping, giving me ideas and suggestions and critiques, and then it just kind of took off from there. And so but when that happened in 2005, print on demand had come along, and so I was able to get them out there to a much bigger audience and go to conventions and stuff with them. And what ended up happening was, after the third one came out, a small press publisher, Permuted Press, Swarm, who their subsidiary was Swarm Press, came and wanted to buy the property. And for 4 years, they licensed it to print them themselves. And it didn't go over huge, but my goodness, being able to say that our property had been licensed by a larger company and they'd paid us and everything, you know, was...
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, that was really cool, because they were looking for superheroes to complement their sort of post-apocalyptic zombie stuff. And they came to Mer Lafferty and Matthew Wayne Selznick and me. And so that was really, talk about validation. That definitely was. And kind of, you know, that spurred me to go on and do the second trilogy. And I wanted to get to the second trilogy because that's where I felt like it was going to be the more cosmic trilogy. The first trilogy, The Grand Design, is really more of a Doctor Doom Kang level stuff going on. The second trilogy is more the Galactus Celestials level stuff. And that's where I felt like we really needed to bring Star Knight in if we were going to, and you were cool with that. What were your thoughts about bringing Star Knight in and actually sort of, you didn't exactly hand the keys over to me, but you certainly let me sit behind the steering wheel with him, you know? So what have your thoughts been, about that?
Oh, I've been perfectly fine with it. I think the only reason I had any trepidation is because at the time I was, well, it's my baby.
Exactly. Sure.
And at the time I was kind of going back and forth, like going, no, I should be the one responsible for writing this stuff. And then I realized I don't have as much time to write, and it wasn't going to happen. And I think it was, you know, it's like Lucas said, it's time to turn over the reins to somebody else to write him. And
but as long as you had creative control, though,
I want input on it, because there's a certain feel in my mind to how Star Knight works, mm-hmm. and he won't be the character without that feel. But at the same time, I also was like, well, but you're writing the stories. I don't want to tell you what to do.
And I think we've managed to work that balance.
Oh, you've added some elements to it that I had never thought of, that when I go back now and think about it, I'm like, wow, this is a much richer universe. The whole new knights and things mm-hmm. like that. So there's a lot of places to play with the character in there that weren't open before. Because before, he was just really, you know, Captain Marvel. he was a kid who could turn into this really powerful super being,
yeah.
that you know, kind of played off my love for the Green Lanterns and, you know, Rom Space Knight and that sort of thing.
Sure.
So
yeah, there's a number of archetypes that are similar, but he really is his own thing, and in the way that sort of we've approached him as a human, as a teenager, and his relationship with his little, you know, girlfriend, friend, and his family, and and kind of as he's trying to discover what he can do and what his responsibilities and his obligations are and who's out to get him, you know, it's been unfolding very slowly. I mean, it's funny, if I had any desire to quit writing the Sentinels after, like, the, say, for example, after the current trilogy I'm working on now, which will be volume 7, 8, and 9, I would have to just still keep writing Star Knight books, I think, because I'd want to keep exploring him, you know, and keep,
right.
keep going with that whole storyline. And I wanted to say, he is your baby. And believe me, when I write him, I act like when I'm holding somebody else's baby. Very, very careful.
You've done a very good job.
Oh, well, I appreciate it. And he's a great character, see, so it's a privilege to have him. We did introduce, and I don't want to give any spoilers, because, you know, believe it or not, lots of people have been reading these books. It still blows my mind, but they sell very, very well now. So, relatively speaking, you know, for small press. And so we do introduce some new interesting, I don't know if I would say supporting characters or enemies. It kind of remains to be seen. But Star Knight is kind of coming up in the days ahead up against not only, you know, his own personal, and this is Mitch Michelson, not only his own issues with being a teenage kid in America that suddenly has been thrust, you know, almost Hal Jordan-like into this role, but he's also having to deal with enemies that Star Knight had way before he was Star Knight.
Right.
And that to me is very interesting too, because they have preconceived notions of his beliefs, how he's going to react. And he doesn't have a clue, right? Why would he?
He still doesn't have a complete clue about what the armor is, or or what it, you know, where it came from, what its purpose was.
Mm-hmm.
He's just a kid who suddenly, you know, at initial blush, he got his dream. I'm a superhero. Now I can fly around and save, you know, planes that are falling out of the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And he hasn't really sat down and thought about the responsibility of the amount of power that he has yet. So,
you know, his interactions with the other Sentinels, because he did get to interact with them a good bit in the last two books in World Mind and Stellar Axe, when he had to go out in space and kind of, he was essentially like their Thor character showing up in a, you know, like think of an Avengers under shooter where everybody but Thor would be pinned down and almost on the brink of destruction, and then Thor would show up and give him a chance.
Right.
And Star Knight kind of has played that role sort of where he could show up and at least give him a big gun that put him on a par with the enemy to some degree. His interactions with the other characters, the other Sentinels, haven't been as interesting to me yet, except for a couple. It's interesting when Ezra talks to him, because Ezra Brack is sort of my science inventor, you know, Tony Stark, Reed Richards
he's
type character.
The genius.
Yeah. But he's got more of a Hawkeye personality than a Tony. Well, see, this is the funny thing, by the way. I don't want to go off on a tangent here, but that's the funny thing is that what they discovered in the Iron Man movies is exactly what we did with Ezra 15 years ago, right?
Right.
You take Tony Stark and you give him Clint Barton's personality. I'm like, holy crap, they made Tony Stark a big
smart ass.
Yeah, they made Tony Stark a popular character by making him Ezra.
Well, it's funny how many people who have seen only the movies but not read the comic books, they think that's Tony Stark. But Tony Stark wasn't like that. He was far more straight-laced.
Yeah, that's the comic book. That's Hawkeye, exactly. And that was my sort of inspiration when I created Ezra Brakus, was to say, what if you had Tony Stark and you gave him Clint Barton's personality? And danged if isn't that what they did in the – and it took me a couple of years to figure that out.
I think they gave him Robert Downey Jr.'s personality.
Well, yeah. Well, that's right. That's right. Yeah. So Ezra's interaction with Star Knight is kind of like every now and then he sort of does a double take at things that Mitch will say inside the armor, right? I mean, because he's like, wait, you're like this 1,000-year-old alien juggernaut, and you sound like this kid from Tennessee or something, because he is, right?
You're starstruck, yeah, and you don't seem to know what I think you should know.
Right. But I think that the one that's really interesting is Mitch and Star Knight's relationship with Pulsar, because she's only a little bit older than him, and she's the one that I think that's quicker than anybody to kind of recognize that there's somebody similar to her, you know, inside
right.
her. because she's kind of a nerdy science nerd character. She's a college student, and you know, I think that she and Mitch would be buddies to a certain degree if they hung out together. But I don't think she's yet encountered him outside of the armor, so she doesn't yet know exactly what's going on there. So,
right.
So that's going to be interesting to explore in the books ahead, I think. Yeah, he's a character that offers endless possibilities, and I'm looking forward to it. All right, well, let's see. Is there anything else that you would like to add as far as what the folks should know or what you're going to be doing? Or
oh goodness, I'm just going to help you when you need it.
I got to get you to write a robot story for me, right?
Well, I've got that idea. I've been mulling it over in my head. I just haven't put pen to paper yet, or hand to keyboard.
Right.
So I like the idea that I've got, and hopefully I can flesh it out and get it to you pretty soon.
We're talking about doing I'm not going to give away the title or anything yet, but we've got a cover, we've got a concept, we've got some writers on board. So maybe sometime in 2013 we'll have a book out. That I'm planning on editing and maybe doing a story for too, involving robots and it just sort of as a general theme. And so, yeah, I'm looking forward to what you can come up with, because I haven't really said this yet, but yeah, you've written some stuff on your own, and it was stuff that, you know, back in the day, and it's stuff that the ideas sort of informed the Sentinels as I was writing the novels. And your stuff is always hilarious. I mean, you bring a comedy level beyond anything I can ever achieve. And so I always enjoy the comedy level, the wacky sort of absurdity level that you're able to put into a lot of your stories. And so that's one reason I'm really looking forward to that.
Well, I'm not sure that story is going to be absurd, but we'll see. The comedy I do kind of just flows out of me. It's not always there unless it just hits that situation. So,
all right. Well, that's cool. Well, I want to thank Bobby Polite for joining me today and kind of walking down memory lane with the things that influenced us and what we're kind of doing with them today. And I also want to thank the ESO Network guys for having our show in their network now. It's an incredible honor, and I appreciate it. You can find the Sentinels books that Bobby and I have put so much love and effort into these characters and everything if you go to whiterocketbooks.com. They have their own section there under on the White Rocket Books page. If you go to plexico.net, you can find the links and find whatever else I'm working on from various publishers, including White Rocket. And you can find me at Facebook or on Twitter at Van Allen Plexico, or just Van Allen Plexico. And if you have any questions for Bobby or anything else that we've done on the series so far, I've neglected to say this till now, but send me a tweet or a Facebook message or an email, and I will pass it on, and we'll talk about it and address it in a segment of the upcoming show. So thanks a bunch for listening. I think the White Rocket's about to sail on out of here. Bobby, it's good to talk to you, man.
Very good talking to you. Thank you for having me.
All right.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.